Do you, Baron Frankenstein, take this woman to be your bride? Do you promise to haunt her with old horror movies, toys, and comics?
Yes, I want Fran. Woman. Fran.
And you, Baroness, do you take this man beast to be your lawfully bound husband? Do you promise to endure hours of unimaginable torture as he rambles about monster movies and long-dead actors? Close enough. Then by the power invested in me by Count Alucard, I now pronounce you supermates. You may bite or kiss the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 41 of Supermates Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
And we are here for our final trip of this year into the House of Frankenstein. As this episode drops, it'll just be a little bit, a week or two before Halloween, according to my current plans for dropping episodes. So, happy Halloween in advance. So, we're going to wrap things up. We're going to have a movie that I think is kind of underrated, and I don't think a lot of people, it seems like a lot of people don't know about it. Although, oddly enough, I had already planned on doing this, and then Derek M. Cook over at Monster Kid Radio, he did two episodes on this movie. And so I love Monster Kid Radio, but I did not listen to them before we did this.
To make sure that there wasn't any...
Yeah, make sure I didn't, you know, subconsciously plagiarize him. Because there's enough, you know, almost plagiarizing going on in this movie. So, and actually what we're talking about, when is a Universal monster movie not a Universal monster movie?
When it's produced by Columbia.
Right, exactly. So we're going to talk about 1943's Return of the Vampire starring Bela Lugosi. I actually found this film in the $5 bin at a Food Lion grocery store about 10 years ago.
Of all places.
Yeah. And I'm like, what is this? I'm like, but it was like $5. It had Bela Lugosi. It was a vampire movie. So I'm like, hey, I'm in, you know, with knowing very little about it. And I saw a werewolf on the cover of it. I'm like, okay, it's a vampire and a werewolf. And to my mind, I didn't think anybody else had done werewolf movies except Universal.
Right.
So Return of the Vampire was released November 11th, 1943, so almost Halloween, but still not quite. Written by Griffin J., Kurt Newman, and Randall Fay. Directed by Lou Landers. It starred Bela Lugosi as Armand Tesla and Dr. Hugo Bruckner. Frieda Enniscourt as Lady Jane Ainslie. Nina Folk as Nikki Saunders. Roland Varno as John Ainslie. Miles Mander as Sir Frederick Fleet. Matt Willis as Andreas Orby. Otola Nesmith as Elsa Walters, the governess. Gilbert Emery as Dr. Walter Saunders. Leslie Dennison as Detective Lynch. And William Austin as Detective Gannett.
Our film begins in an alleyway with a woman in period dress backing away from a caped figure with a high collar. He spreads his cape over her and she screams. Over this scene, text reads, "The imagination of man at times sires the fantastic and the grotesque. That the imagination of man can soar into the stratosphere of fantasy is attested by the Return of the Vampire."
Dun dun dun.
This is the case of Armand Tesla, vampire, as compiled from the personal notes of Professor Walter Saunders, King's College, Oxford. The following events took place in the outskirts of London towards the close of the year 1918. They began on the night of October the 15th, a particularly gloomy, foggy night that was well suited for a visitation by the supernatural.
In the Priory Cemetery that night, a well-dressed werewolf in a two-piece suit stalks the foggy grounds. He enters one of the crypts and awakens his master, Armand Tesla, who rises from his coffin. The werewolf, Andreas, tells his master of how his latest victim still lives and how her doctors don't suspect the true nature of her ailment. The vampire leaves his tomb and heads out into the night.
Meanwhile, at Dr. Jane Ainslie's sanitarium, she and mentor Professor Walter Saunders, unaware of the vampire's existence, examine the blood of his victim, while Lady Jane's young son John and Saunders' granddaughter Nikki enjoy each other's company. Seeing nothing wrong with the sample to indicate anemia despite her massive blood loss, the two observe the patient once more, with Saunders noting her dilated pupils point to some type of hypnotism. The woman becomes hysterical, raving about her dreams and eyes like burning coals. When a strong wind blows through the open window, she screams, "I didn't tell them!" Shortly thereafter, the woman is dead.
Seeking answers outside of medicine and science, Professor Saunders reads the work of Dr. Armand Tesla.
From the beginning of time, man has been troubled by the uncertainty of death and by the rare and horrible manifestations which occur at intervals in which the dead are known to return from their graves.
In the sleeping children's room, a caped figure in top hat appears at their window. A mist swirls outside and breaks through a pane of glass in the door and enters the room and engulfs the screaming Nikki as it casts the shape of a man.
The next morning, Saunders shares something with Lady Jane he hadn't noticed before.
Lacerations about the size of pinpricks on the throat.
What?
Look.
Needle pricks, surely.
No. I paid no attention to those marks on her throat last night because they seemed unimportant. This morning, I know better.
What then do they indicate?
Incisions made by the teeth of a vampire.
A vampire? A bat? An animal?
No, Jane, not a bat. A vampire. A monster. A fantastic something that draws blood from the human body through the jugular veins of its victim. This thirst for blood is akin to all craving for food. Without human blood, they perish. Listen to these notes that I have made from the writings of a Romanian scientist, an authority on vampirism. Armand Tesla, who lived 200 years ago. This, for instance, once attacked. The victim of a vampire is completely dominated by this creature.
But surely vampires exist only in the imagination.
Did imagination make those marks on her throat?
But...
was it reality or fantasy that caused the dogs to bark last night as the wolves were about?
But this is ridiculous. I Milady. Can't believe
it. Milady!
What is it, Elsie?
It's Nikki. I can't wake her.
Nikki!
Saunders and Jane find Nikki unconscious, marked with the same pinpricks. Saunders gives her an immediate transfusion. Saunders is convinced they are dealing with a vampire and tells Lady Jane how they must be destroyed.
According to this Dr. Armand Tesla, a vampire can only be destroyed by driving a spike through its heart while it sleeps in its coffin, or by forcing it out into the bright sunlight, which will cause it to shrivel and perish.
We can't see this thing through by ourselves.
Yes, we can. A vampire must rest during the day in the soil in which it was buried.
But the coffin might be hidden anywhere.
Could it? How many graveyards are there in this vicinity?
Well, there's the church fields and the burial ground at Old Priory, but that's been abandoned for years.
Then we must try them both and pray for guidance.
At the Priory Cemetery, Saunders and Jane follow bare footprints into a crypt and then to a coffin inside. Lifting the coffin lid, they find a man seemingly alive. To prove his vampirism, Saunders points a mirror at his face, seeing only an empty suit reflected in the glass. His theory proven, Professor Saunders pounds a metal stake into the vampire's chest. A distressed Andreas enters the tomb, much to Lady Jane's horror. Collapsing over his master's death, he reverts to his human form. Saunders and Jane vow to help the man.
In the present, Sir Frederick Fleet of Scotland Yard cannot believe what he has just read. Having found the manuscript in the effects of the recently deceased Professor Saunders, Fleet has called Lady Jane in for questioning.
My dear lady, you simply can't go around the country driving things through people's hearts.
I quite understand, Sir Frederick.
This person that you and Professor Saunders disposed of, who was he?
Armand Tesla, the depraved Romanian scientist, who died in 1744, shortly after he published his work on vampirism. Tesla's morbid thirst for knowledge turned upon him, and after his death, he himself became a vampire.
Oh, rubbish. There's no such thing as a vampire.
You're wrong, Sir Frederick.
And Tesla's man Friday, this Andreas, what happened to him?
For years, Tesla had him under complete hypnotic control. But with Tesla's destruction, Andreas was released from this nightmare. And after years of patient care and treatment, he was restored to normal. Today, he's perfectly well and invaluable to me and my work.
My dear Lady Jane, I have the greatest respect and admiration for you, like everyone else in England. But you must remember that I'm Chief Commissioner for Scotland Yard. And as such, there's only one thing I can do. That grave must be opened. And if we discover the remains of a man with a spike through his heart, well, then I'm very much afraid that you'll be liable to prosecution for murder.
Later at the Ainsley estate, Lady Jane greets John and Nikki, now engaged to be married. John, recently discharged from the British Royal Air Force due to injuries, is preparing to conduct a concert in London. In private, Jane speaks to her son about Fleet's desire to exhume Tesla's grave. Although Jane is sure she can prove Tesla's vampirism if the body is unearthed, she is concerned on the effect it will have on Nikki, who doesn't remember any of her brush with the supernatural. Mother and son notice an obviously rattled Andreas has overheard them, but their conversation is cut short by a German air raid. The bombings make a direct hit on the Priory Cemetery.
The next morning, two comic relief volunteers arrive at the cemetery to help clean up the destruction. They find Tesla's unearthed body and the spike through his chest. Believing it to be debris from the bombing, they remove it and bury him once more, despite hearing what they believe to be an audible groan from his body.
That night, Lady Jane sends Andreas on a mission similar to ones he has performed before. He is to meet with a scientist named Hugo Bruckner, recently freed from a Nazi concentration camp, and escort him to his new residence at the Professionals Club. Before he leaves, Andreas admits to overhearing Jane and John's discussion earlier, and that he fears what may happen if Tesla is somehow released from his prison. Elsewhere, the hand of Armand Tesla frees itself from the loose earth he was buried in, and he stalks the night once more. Walking through the foggy woods on his way to meet Dr. Bruckner, Andreas is confronted by a voice from his past, incessantly calling his name.
You have no power over me. That was ended many years ago. I'm no longer your slave. Dr. Ainsley has cleansed me of all the evil that you forced upon me. You can't bring it back. You can't. I won't let you. I won't.
You're a fool, Andreas. A complete, utter fool. Your fate is to be what you are, as mine is to be what I am, your master. Come here.
I won't. I won't.
Look at me, Andreas. Look at me.
Unable to resist Tesla's power, Andreas reverts to a werewolf once more.
Andreas, come here.
Master, you have come back.
Lady Jane Ainsley and Professor Walter Saunders imprisoned me, deprived me of life for the past 23 years. It was my curse that caused Professor Saunders' recent death. It shall not be a simple for Lady Jane.
How will you do it, Master?
Through those she loves the most. Come, Andreas. I must find a new resting place. There you will bring the coffin with my native soil. And then, Andreas, I have other plans.
Sometime later, in the ruined remains of St. Matthias Church, Andreas reports to his master in his new home. The werewolf gleefully explains how he murdered Dr. Bruckner and the men who helped him escape to England. He gives Bruckner's personal effects to Tesla so he may assume the doctor's identity.
The next day, Commissioner Fleet and Lady Jane visit the Priory Cemetery, only to find the spot where she and Professor Saunders buried Tesla to be an empty hole, thanks to the Blitz. That evening, Jane hosts an engagement party for John and Nikki, and both Fleet and Dr. Bruckner attend. Jane does not recognize Bruckner, but Nikki seems to be familiar with him somehow. Lady Jane offers Bruckner free run of her hospital and laboratory facilities. The following day, Lady Jane notices her desk drawer has been opened, and Professor Saunders' manuscript stolen. Fleet examines the desk and takes a hair sample from the broken drawer. As Nikki prepares for bed that night, she notices the manuscript on her chair and reads it. In her sleep later, she hears Tesla's voice calling her. Answering it, she finds the vampire in Jane's study.
Who are you?
Why,
have you forced me to come here?
You read your father's manuscript. Look at me, Nikki. Now tell me who I am.
You are Armand Tesla. But Tesla's dead.
I am Tesla. And I can never die. And you are mine. Mine forever. But before I take you away from here, there are many things I will make you do for me. Then you will go with me to my native country, where no death can claim you or tear us apart. Your mind is no longer your own. I shall command, and you shall obey. Look at me, Nikki. Look at me. Look at me.
Nikki collapses, and Tesla approaches her prone body.
Elsa, the governess, finds Nikki's unconscious body on the floor of her room and screams. Lady Jane is horrified to find the pinpricks back on her neck and gives her an immediate transfusion. Determined to get to the bottom of this, Jane questions the two men who reburied Tesla's corpse. They are shocked to find that the grave is empty as well, but Jane is not. She is surprised to see that one of the men is wearing Tesla's old ring. When he finds out where it came from, he gives it back to Lady Jane. Commissioner Fleet is still not convinced. He asks two of his men, Lynch and Gannett, to track Andreas. They spot him leaving the professionals club with a bundle under his arm, and when they begin to question him, Andreas wolfs out. After roughing them up, he runs away, leaving his bundle behind. The bundle is marked Bruckner. Fleet, of course, is less convinced by their story of Andreas's transformation, but when his lab analysis of the hair from Lady Jane matches that of a wolf and hair ripped from Andreas in the fight, he is forced to begin to reconsider.
In the evening, Nikki follows Tesla's commands and goes to John's room as he prepares for his concert. John is somewhat flummoxed by Nikki's strange trance-like manner. The vampire watches from the window as the two embrace.
Because he's a creeper.
When he doesn't arrive at the concert, Jane finds John unconscious in his room, bearing the mark of the vampire. Fleet asks a visiting Dr. Bruckner his opinion on the case.
Well, Dr. Bruckner, what are you to say about this?
Is this a police interrogation?
Now, look here, sir. Don't beat about the bush. Do you believe this was an attack by a vampire?
There are many strange things in the world, Sir Frederick. Vampirism may be one of them.
Ah.
And you still say there is no such thing as a vampire. I repeat, Armand Tesla is one. And he lives. With Nikki already in his power, he has set out to destroy John, too. Heaven knows who may be his next victim.
Nikki, your eyes. I never saw them so queer. Stop staring at me like that. Nikki!
Fleet and Lady Jane confront Andreas and are shocked to find his hands covered in fur. He refuses to divulge the location of his master and flees out an open window. The commissioner and the lady then visit Bruckner's room at the professional club, only to find it empty. Fleet reads a description of Bruckner he has uncovered, one that is vastly different from the man they know. They also find the mirror in the room turned toward the wall, and Tesla's ring, somehow lifted from Lady Jane's home. Speaking with a conflicted Nikki later, Jane assures her that John still loves her despite what has happened. A cross placed near her for protection gives Jane an idea that may put an end to their horror. That night, Jane plays her organ, and as she expected, Tesla appears.
Good evening, Lady Ainsley.
I've been expecting you, Dr. Bruckner.
So at last, through Andreas, you learned who I am. How great must be your satisfaction to realize how well you cured him.
There is good in Andreas' soul. Good that I have placed there, and which even you cannot destroy, Armand Tesla.
What a fool you are. With all your scientific knowledge, you have achieved nothing. You are too late to stop what I have set out to do. I have waited for this moment for a long time. Tonight, I will take Nikki away. Her soul will wander through the night, and you will never find where her body rests. Then, in another form, She will come back for John.
You're lying. You attacked my son and made Nikki believe that she did it.
You're a very brilliant woman, but a foolish one to pit your strength against mine.
It is possible that you may take Nikki, but there is something stronger than even you, something greater that you have forgotten. You are evil. But even the power of evil cannot stand against the power of faith and goodness. And with that power, you will be destroyed.
Lady Jane removes her sheet music and reveals a lighted cross which repels Tesla. A vampire disappears in a cloud of smoke. In Nikki's room, she is awakened once more by Tesla's voice. She answers his summons, and Jane and Commissioner Fleet follow as Andreas watches them.
Nikki meets Tesla and Andreas at the Priory Cemetery as the air raid sirens sound once more. Fleet shoots the werewolf as the bombs begin to fall. A wounded Andreas retrieves Nikki's unconscious body, but Jane and Fleet have lost their trail. Back at the St. Matthias Church, Andreas begs his master for help.
Help me, Master. I am hurt.
What is that to me?
But I'll die. You must not let that happen, Master. You promised me life eternal, like yours forever.
I no longer need you, Andreas. Your usefulness is over.
You must not say that, Master.
Get away from me. Idiot. Get back to that corner. Remain there. Die.
Tesla turns his attention to the unconscious Nikki, preparing her grave. As he awaits death, Andreas finds a crucifix in the church ruins. Staring at it, he hears Lady Jane's voice.
You are saved, Andreas, because I have taught you the meaning of goodness. You hold it now, locked tightly in your heart, and nothing evil can ever stand against it again. Always remember that goodness is the strongest force in the world, and that all evil cannot prevail against it. Remember that, and you will be strong. Strong. Strong.
With this, he reverts to his human form and approaches Tesla with the crucifix as he prepares to bite Nikki. With Tesla backing away from his former slave, another bombing hits the church.
As Fleet and Lady Jane coordinate a search, Andreas and Nikki come too. Andreas drags the body of his tormentor out into the sun. The weakened vampire attempts to struggle to no avail. With a loose brick, Andreas hammers a spike through his heart as Nikki observes in horror. With this, Tesla's ancient body begins to disintegrate. When Fleet and Jane find them, Nikki informs her that Andreas destroyed their old foe. Fleet, still incredulous to the whole affair, is still having trouble dealing with all of the supernatural goings-on, even going so far to break the fourth wall in search of answers.
Well, there's one of them, Andreas. Doesn't look much like a werewolf now, does he?
He isn't now. Poor Andreas. He found his soul, after all. May he have peace forever.
But who this blighter is, I don't know. He looks to me more like a bundle of rags and bones. Looks as if he'd been lying there for some time.
That, my dear Sir Frederick, is all that is left of Amor Tesla. Now, do you believe in vampires?
Dear Jane, must you go back over all that?
Very well, then. If it isn't Tesla or Bruckner, perhaps you'll tell me who it is.
Say, you fellas don't believe in this vampire business, do you?
Yes, sir.
We do.
And do you people?
So, this is the third time that Bela Lugosi played a vampire on screen. Of course, he played Dracula in the Universal Classic, and he had played him on stage before that. That made him a star, but of course it also typecast him in boogeyman-type roles.
Right.
He actually traded on his Dracula persona in Mark of the Vampire, in 1935 for MGM. That was with Dracula director Todd Browning, and it was a remake of Browning's lost classic movie London After Midnight, which had starred Lon Chaney. In both versions of that, the vampire is really a disguise for the detective character, so there's not an actual supernatural element to it.
Oh, okay.
Lugosi, this is only the second time that Lugosi plays a true vampire. His appearance was fairly similar in Mark of the Vampire, but it's pretty much dead on to Dracula in this, except for his medallion.
Right.
That's the only thing he's really missing. He's got the white opera shirt. He's got the black
tuxedo,
jacket, the tuxedo.
Yeah.
But he's the only thing he's missing is the ribbon in the medallion, which, I mean, we assume it's red because it was in black and white. It's kind of weird because Universal, if you look at their output, they had pretty much abandoned the Dracula character after Dracula's Daughter in 1936. They actually paid Lugosi to not appear in that movie. He was supposed to, and then they wrote him out of the script, and then they had to pay him.
Oh.
So Dracula is seen as, like, a dummy at the beginning of the movie.
Why'd they write him out?
Who knows?
And that is just dumb.
Yeah, it's really amazing to think they had a franchise sitting there and didn't do anything with it. I mean, I know it's different now than it was then, but obviously they made sequels to Frankenstein.
Right.
And, you know, eventually they catch on and start making sequels to The Mummy, you know, and as soon as the Wolfman took off, you know, they made a lot of use out of him and kept using Lon Chaney as him. So it's really strange if you think about it, how Dracula got left in the dust. So, you know, Columbia, they're like, hey, we can make a Dracula sequel.
Why not?
I don't know if Dracula was in the public domain at that point. I know he wasn't initially. When Universal made the movie, that Stoker's widow was still involved.
Right.
Because she had had supposedly all the prints of Nosferatu destroyed.
Right.
Because when that was made in Germany without her permission, even though they changed the names. Universal reportedly.
It was actually filmed in the Carpathian Mountains, Nosferatu was.
Right.
It was not filmed on a set.
Right.
And that was, you know, of course, in 1922, considered the first horror movie. And the reason I say this is I'm actually getting ready to show it at the library, so.
Oh, very cool. Nosferatu is just, I watched it a few years ago all the way through for the first time. That is a very creepy and unsettling movie even today. I think the silence and creakiness of it, you know, make it much sore. But freaking Max Schreck as Nosferatu is just still freaking creepy. There's just no two ways about it.
But anyway, back to this.
That's
sorry,
okay.
Tangent.
That's all right. Columbia hires Bela Lugosi, you know, to play a, you know, Dracula. Now, accounts vary on how much it really was going to be really Dracula, but some people say, no, it was never really going to be Dracula. It was always going to be a different vampire. Others say that, yes, at one point, they really were going to call the character Dracula, and that Universal threatened a plagiarism suit on him. But either way, he became Armand Tesla.
Mm.
Was he named after the scientist?
I don't know. That, I mean, as
was
soon as I saw that
after
name.
After the band, you know?
Love
will find a way.
Oh.
So you some late 80s hair metal there. So kind of weird to think that Lugosi never got to star in a proper Dracula sequel. He only played him on film one more time in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. So many Universal horror fans consider this a sequel to Dracula anyway, you know, so. And in a weird way, it's kind of like the movie is a sequel to its own self because there's that story at the beginning.
Right,
and then it
right.
jumps ahead, you know, however, what is it, like?
23 years,
yeah. So,
I'm sorry, I just remembered that.
You know, it's kind of interesting because it says, I think, you know, I just assumed it was set in contemporary, like 1943 London, but I guess maybe it's like a few years back. Because I think it said on IMDb that, I didn't look myself, but the program for John's concert said something, the date was 1940, which would have made it more like 22 years instead of 23. So there's some weird, sometime
well,
in the early 1940s,
yeah.
During the Blitz and during World War II. So.
While England was under attack.
Right, exactly. And we'll get to that in a minute. So apparently Columbia held the release of this back by 3 months because Universal did finally wake up and make a new Dracula film, which was Son of Dracula, with Lon Chaney Jr. as Count Alucard in the same year. The Count returned in the form of John Carradine for 1944's House of Frankenstein, and then 1945's House of Dracula. So, still no Bela Lugosi. Way to go, Universal. Anyway, unlike Universal, Columbia didn't really have much experience with supernatural thrillers, so their approach is kind of a throwback to an earlier time pre-Dracula, when movies like London After Midnight, and by extension its remake, Mark of the Vampire, treated the supernatural thing as a hoax. They always explained it away at the end.
Right.
It couldn't be a true supernatural movie. Dracula was the first movie that was like, no, this is a supernatural movie. In fact, the character of Van Helsing, played by Edward Van Sloan, there's a scene that's not on The Prince of Dracula now where he would basically, like, he was standing in front of the stage and he would say, you know, he would basically start to lead you to believe that, okay, you know, this is all fake or something. But at the end, he said, there are such things, you know.
Oh, okay.
So this was kind of like the opposite of that, because what you get at the end of this movie, he's making you question it. That was kind of easing people into the notion that it was a real supernatural thing. But this is like 12 years later, and Columbia is still treating it, you know, like they did in Dracula. So, but into the movie itself, I really liked the opening scene in the graveyard. It reminded me a lot of the scene in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman from the same year. I mean, you know, which we talked about earlier in the second episode of House of Frankenstein this year. And, you know, I was pretty shocked to see, one, I mean, we all have talked about the fact that Lon Chaney Jr. is one snappy dresser as a werewolf.
He changes
his clothes after he starts to transform, but Andreas has got on a tie, you know. He doesn't have shoes on, but he's got a suit. He's got a tie on, and he talks, which is...
To me, what is the point of him making him into a werewolf if he's going to be his servant? I mean, wouldn't it be better if his servant blended into society? Why make him stand out as a werewolf?
Maybe he had to transform him to control him like that. But I don't know, he's controlling other people.
I didn't care for that part. I thought it was one thing. Yes, it got a werewolf on screen. Yay for that. But at the same time, as far as did it add anything to the story? No.
Well, I think part of it too is it goes against the werewolf we think of is the Lon Chaney Wolfman.
Right. I mean, he was completely intelligent. He had all of his faculties while he was in werewolf form. I just don't think him turning into a werewolf added anything.
He wasn't savage at all, other than a few growls. And yeah. I mean, even when he gets in a fight later, he's throwing punches. It looks like it's something from a
standard cereal. Doesn't have superhuman strength, because those two guys, you know, the only reason he gets away from them later is because they're surprised that he's a wolf. They would have been able to subdue him if they had been prepared.
Yeah, there's no, he doesn't like rip out anybody's throat. He didn't claw at anybody. He's just throwing punches and stuff. Yeah.
I just don't think it adds.
Well, I think they're basically playing around with the fact that, you know, Dracula and other vampires were supposedly able to control, like, vermin, you know, and wolves and dogs and rats and bats and things and
still meh.
I know, but it's kind of strange. It takes a little bit getting used to. The first time I watched it, I'm like, you know, I think Henry Hull may have said a few things in Werewolf of London while he was a werewolf, but he was still growly. But, you know, Andreas is just downright verbose.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and very gleeful about all this little evil doings he's doing.
Yeah.
And he looks like a Yorkie. I mean, the makeup's well done, but the design of it is just very... I mean, he's got little teeth. He's got fangs, which Bela Lugosi doesn't, which I think is funny. Bela Lugosi never had fangs as a vampire.
Yeah.
But he's got fangs, and he's got like little rows of little doggy teeth. But I mean, he looks like a Yorkie Terrier. He doesn't look like a wolf so much.
Again, meh.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's just... And in fact, there's a movie, I've never seen it. I think Columbia made it, I mean, like in the late 50s, called The Werewolf. Uh-huh. They basically reused this design. I've never seen it, though.
Oh, okay.
So, I need to see that. This, apparently, though, is the first film to feature both a vampire and a werewolf, because it predates House of Frankenstein by nearly a year or so. Matt Willis, who plays Andreas, he doesn't have a lot of credited roles on IMDb. He's got a lot of uncredited roles on there. It's like, you know, it says uncredited. But it jumped out to me because one of those films is Inside the Walls of Folsom Prison.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
Yeah. Midnight is the film that a young Johnny Cash watched while he was in the Air Force in Germany, stationed in Germany, and it inspired him to write the song Folsom Prison Blues. So that's cool to me.
You may have heard of it.
Because I'm a Johnny Cash fan. This was actually Bela Lugosi's last headlining role for a major studio. He had been under contract to Poverty Row, quote-unquote, Studio Monogram prior to this, and he'd done character roles and bit parts for Universal in movies like The Wolfman in the years preceding this, because his star had faded. He would continue to star in low-budget roles, be the headlining star, and he occasionally popped up in character parts after this for the big studios, but they became fewer and fewer as the years went along. And in fact, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein was the last major studio picture he ever appeared in.
That's just sad.
It is really sad. It's really sad. It kind of makes you, you know, especially because even though, you know, Karloff did so well, and even though Lon Chaney Jr. had, you know, he had just as many personal problems, maybe more than Lugosi, because Lugosi got addicted to like morphine and pills. But from all accounts, it was because he was put on them for medical reasons and got addicted to them. You know, and Chaney had his drinking problem, but Chaney always stayed in demand. Even if he was making low budget stuff, he would go back and forth between low budget stuff and decent stuff and character roles.
It makes you wonder what kind of agent Lugosi had.
He apparently went through quite a few, but
so I wonder if that didn't contribute.
Yeah, and of course he ended up in Ed Wood's movies.
Right.
So, which is the bottom of the barrel, you know. I really, you know, getting into Lady Jane, the character of her.
I loved her.
You loved her?
I mean, she was intelligent. She was smart. She was take charge. She told the detective, look, you've got your head up your ASS. This is what's going on. Listen to me. I mean, you know.
Yeah, she was kind of, I mean, she wasn't, you know, as, she didn't, wasn't as sexy, but she kind of reminded me of a Agent Carter type, Peggy Carter type. Maybe the setting, too,
had
something to do with it. You know, she just had that very proper but very take-charge kind of attitude about her. I thought she was a very progressive character for 1940s Hollywood, and definitely the strongest female character in any of the classic horror movies I've seen.
Yeah, exactly.
And she blows away all the characters in the Universal movies, you know.
She's not a screamer.
No.
I appreciate that.
She kind of jumped when she saw Andreas stumbling into the tomb, but who wouldn't?
Yeah.
You know, and they're staking a vampire, so. Plus, you know, she's got a child, and we don't know what happened to Mr. Ainsley.
Mm-hmm.
Was she divorced? Was he dead? I mean, we don't know. Was he killed in World War I? I don't know. They don't say, you know, so. You know, and she's not unattractive, but she's not sexualized in any way either.
No.
I was really shocked by her. It's like,
I really liked her character.
Oh, I did too, but it's like, this was actually, I mean, that's the thing about this movie, and we'll get into that, the fact that it was actually made when it was set, because it is against type and against the way Universal handled their movies made during this period, which we'll get into in a moment when we get to that part. I wasn't really aware of the cast of this film, anybody except outside of Lugosi, with one exception, which again we'll get to later. But apparently Frieda Enniscourt that played Lady Jane was often cast in similar characters, strong, matronly roles. And like we said, she really pulled it off. So kudos to her. I know when we were watching it last night and they introduced the kids, you're like, oh, something ain't gonna happen to those kids, is it?
Well, I mean,
it always makes you squirmy, even back then when they introduce kids into a horror movie.
Yeah.
It usually doesn't end well. Yeah, child endangerment is, once you have kids, that really bothers you.
Yeah.
That's why we had to quit watching like shows like ER and stuff.
It's
a kid dying in every episode. It's like, no thanks.
We're good. No,
yeah.
We're good.
That's a nice drawing of Bela Lugosi in Saunders' book. It looks like something off a Famous Monsters cover.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Basil Gogos around back in 1943? I'm sure he was alive, but maybe he wasn't. I don't know. So when Tesla appears in the kid's window, he wears a top hat like Dracula did in the opera scenes in the original film. And something John Carradine picked up, that was kind of his shtick as Dracula. He always had his top hat on. And I never really cared for him as Dracula, but that's okay. The fog breaking the glass and then creeping in the window, it seems simple now, but it's very effective, very moody, and it looks good, especially when it rapidly shoots at Nikki. I mean, it just like envelops her all at once. It's like they hit some good jets on that thing. On that fog machine.
I just,
yeah, I know. It's like, man, Gilbert Emery, who plays Professor Saunders, was actually in Dracula's Daughter. So he's got one over on Bela Lugosi.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't even in a movie with his own name in the title. So one thing that kind of jumped out at me is
the metal versus
metal
wooden.
Spike. Metal spikes versus wooden stakes. But, you know, that's probably more of a... I have to go back. I've read Dracula many times. And, in fact, you got me a graphic novel version that's by Dick Giordano and Roy Thomas. Mm-hmm. That started Marvel in the 70s and finally finished it a few years before Dick Giordano passed away. Very, very well done if you guys... It's in several different formats, but seek it out. It's great. But I'm pretty sure they went with the wooden stakes, but I... Folklore didn't care what you put in them
as long as
it
the
pinned
heart
them
was pierced.
And
yeah.
It pinned them down. I mean, that's why there's really stakes. It's just like a tent stake. It was the idea that you pin them in the coffin and they couldn't get out. I mean, it was very simple-minded thinking, obviously. Because like we said in another episode, you know, if they heard a groan like air escaping out of a body, uh-huh. or if they happened to look at a body and their fingernails were growing, which they do, and, you know, they had... Rudy, you know, the blood corpuscles were busted in their cheeks and they were red or whatever.
Right.
They'd stake people. They'd behead people. They'd, you know, and especially in Europe. So they just pinned them with whatever. So it's interesting because it's like, you know, at no point does a wooden stake enter this picture, which is kind of weird. But well, I got one question. Why is Andreas always carrying a bundle? I picked up your dry cleaning, master. You know, it's,
or here's a raw steak from the butcher. Yes. You know,
dead prime rib, master. it's like carrying a package through the. I think the only scene he's not is the very first one, and through the rest of the movie, he's always got a package under his arm. Is it Christmas? I mean, come on. That's. I got you a tie, master. I hope you like it. You know.
Oh.
I did like when they showed Tesla's empty suit when they
Lady Jane and Professor Saunders went down.
Yeah, and they put the mirror up to his face and you see this empty, you see the tuxedo and the high collar and the bow tie and no head.
Yeah, that's
it's really cool. So we get back on that whole idea of the werewolf being tied directly to the vampire. That's usually not explored, but it made me think that when Batman fought the monk in one of his early stories in 1939, they couldn't decide if he was a vampire or a werewolf. So I think maybe the Universal movies helped with that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
So since we're not in Universal land, maybe that's why we're getting, okay, a werewolf's just a subordinate to a vampire. You know, I don't know, but that could have something to do with it. When they do the lap dissolves of Andreas changing... They're well done, and they're very similar to what you see with Lon Chaney.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty the same thing. I did like, you know, we jump into the present, whether it's 1940 or 43 or whatever, and Lady Jane is going to possibly be indicted for murder based on Professor Saunders' book.
But to me, why would she be indicted for murder if, you know, they unearthed a corpse and drove a stake to it? Wouldn't it just be... tampering with a dead body?
Yeah.
Why would it be murder?
Yeah. The fact that this guy was alive, maybe they thought he was some kind of creepy dude that liked to sleep in a coffin or something, you know, some kind of
necrophiliac
or something.
I don't know.
It
seems to me like there would be a statute of limitations. Because this obviously happened at least 22, if not 23 years ago.
Mm.
And they're going on, you know, who's to say they're going off of this man's diary, you know, Professor Saunders' diary.
Yeah.
Who's to say it wasn't the ravings of a madman?
Yeah, but she agrees with it. And she said, yeah, we did it. You know, she's honest
but
with
still,
him about
yeah,
it.
But still, yeah, why did he pursue it to start with?
Well, I guess he kind of felt like he had to.
We wouldn't have a movie. It's in the script.
We wouldn't have a movie. There's another thing that comes up in a minute that's like, Why did this not happen? But anyway, that's like we wouldn't have a movie. Oddly enough, you know, at the end of the Dracula movie, Professor Van Helsing stakes Dracula in his coffin. And in Dracula's Daughter, it picks up with that, and he's arrested. Because they see, hey, you know, what you do? You know, there's a body. Although I think originally it was supposed to disintegrate, but for convenience of the sequel, it doesn't. And then she burns it later. She burns her, the daughter burns his body. But But yeah, so, you know, it's kind of, they picked up the same wrinkle here. You know, it's like, hey, what are you doing going around staking people?
You know.
They grade up Ennis Court's hair and under her eyes to make her look older, but she looks more tired than old, I think, through the eyes. It's like,
but you also have to figure she's living in wartime England.
Well, that's true,
and
too.
And she's a doctor.
Well, that's true, too.
So, to me, probably it's pretty busy. Still work. Yeah.
Yeah. Miles Mander, who played Commissioner Fleet, he appeared in several Universal horror-related titles, including Tower of London with Karloff, and the color remake of Phantom of the Opera with Claude Rains. So he had some Universal cred. Setting this film in contemporary blitzed London was definitely a bold move on Columbia's part. Universal totally ignored World War II, with many of their horror films taking place in a European fairyland that couldn't possibly exist while they were made.
Right.
I mean, there's never any reference. You know, they're in Germany. I mean, very obvious German towns. You know, like in Frankenstein Meets Wolfman.
Uh-huh.
And it's set now, it's set in the present, and never comes up. You know, this movie
uses it as a plot device.
It's a plot device. It's a good chunk of the, I mean, it makes things happen. I mean, it causes him to be freed, and it ultimately, you know, as we've discussed, it ultimately, you know, it contributes to his end. Uh-huh. So, you know. And of course, as we've talked about, just like we talked about The Mummy last time, every horror movie has to have some comedy relief. And that goes all the way back to James Whale in Frankenstein, and especially Bride of Frankenstein and Invisible Man. The two guys that, you know, rebury Tesla, pull the spike out of him. But they're not too bad. But,
no.
You know, your typical kind of Cockney, Cool Blimey, you know, those type guys. Sorry, Andy Leyland, if you're listening. Apples and pears, fish and chips. So we even get...
I had nothing to do with that. Not a bit.
We even get Allied underground action smuggling in German scientists. I mean,
right.
Wow, that's cool. You know, very topical for the time. So
again, you know, that goes back to Lady Jane. She's
in the whole... She's kicking Nazi ass all the way around, man. She is like Peggy Carter.
There you go.
You can understand why Andreas is very apprehensive about the grave being dug up. He doesn't want anything to do with that. And you can, and obviously it does come back to haunt him, which is you really do feel bad for the guy, you know. The scene where Tesla's hand comes up from the grave, that's pretty damn creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I'm pretty sure that's Lugosi, because his fingers are doing all the crazy Lugosi double jointed things he does that nobody else can do. It really looks like his hands. You know, it's not anybody's like stubby. It's not a stand-in hand with stubby fingers or anything like that. And when Tesla confronts Andreas, he doesn't stand a chance. I think that scene in particular just shows how good Lugosi was at a role like that. He has a very otherworldly nature about him. I think other actors, if they had even said some of that stuff, they'd been like, "Oh yeah, what a cornball." But with Bela Lugosi, you're like, I buy it.
Yeah.
Because there's just something about that guy that's like, okay, like other people have said, it's like, okay, vampire, gotcha. You know, it's like, just made for the role, you know. Okay, here's my huge plot hole.
Thank you. Me too.
Yep, so
Me
Logic too. Lass and the Legion of Substitute member Logic, I don't even think I'd be Legion of Substitute member. I'd be like the Wanderers or the Heroes of Lalor or whatever. Super, super... obscure Legion of Superhero team, Logic Lad. Why doesn't Lady Jane recognize Armand Tesla?
Exactly.
She saw him in the coffin. She saw his picture in the book, the portrait of him, the drawing.
Right.
I mean, you think you'd remember the face of a guy laying in a coffin that you drove a stake through.
You know, and she's just like, oh, you know.
I've never seen Dr. Bruckner. She didn't even say, he looks a lot like Armand Tesla.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like... You know, it's like Nikki kind of like, there's something familiar about this guy. But Lady Jane, who saw him when she wasn't under any kind of trance or anything, doesn't recognize him. That's the huge plot hole in this movie. I'm like, if they had one line, when like in the organ scene, when she's like, you obviously clouded my mind earlier, so I didn't recognize you.
Exactly.
One line would have took care of that, you know, from her. And it would have been like, but now I'm onto you, you know. But yeah, it's, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's, yeah. Oh, man. But, oh, I forgot. I meant to say that a scene earlier when Andreas comes and brings his Dr. Bruckner bundle to Tesla. Now, that time it didn't make sense because he had a reason to break him stuff. But, you know, he gleefully talks about how he killed the men and tied rocks to their feet and threw them in the harbor. He's, like, downright giddy about it. It's like, oh, man. It's like, ugh. I mean, even the wolf man, when he kills people, he's just like an animal. He doesn't know what he's doing. You know, it's like, wow. Nina Cock, Coach?
Cook.
Oh, like Derek M. Cook. Uh-huh. It's spelled the same way. Cook. So there you go, Derek, who played Nikki.
Now, that's one thing. This is a little nitpicky thing on my part.
Okay.
I wish they had used any other name than Nikki.
Why?
There is something about it that doesn't lend itself to being in that time period to me. If they had
said, it was made in that time period.
I know. But there's something about it. And then the fact that Lugosi called her Nikki.
Nikki.
He should have called her Nicole.
Nicole, come here. Yeah.
He should. I mean, I'm serious.
No, I've got you.
I mean, he seriously should have. He should not have called. For him to call her Nikki did not work. It should have been Nicole. And it was a nitpicky thing, and I realize that, but.
It was a nitpicky thing. Oh, Nikki, you're so fine. You're so fine, you blow my mind. Hey, Nikki. Ow. Sorry. Oh, I get you. It does seem a little modern. But speaking of modern, she shows quite a bit of skin for 1943. You know, I mean, not a whole lot, but it's like more than you get in the Universal movies usually. Like, Evelyn Anchors is usually more covered up, you know, than she is. She actually went on to, she had tons of credits on her IMDb page, including the Ten Commandments and Spartacus. So she did a lot of the sword and sandal type movies of the 50s. So there's some creepy sexual connotations going on between Tesla and Nikki, considering he marked her when she was a kid. It's like the part of Carmilla that they cut out of The Vampire Lovers, where, you know, she visited the girls when they were young, and, you know, that we talked about, remember? Yeah. It's kind of like that.
It's just like, I'm just waiting for you to grow up old enough so I can nail you.
It's like Celine Dion and her husband.
Oh, shit. Christopher.
I'm sorry. you know, that ring of Tesla's is kind of freaky. You know, it's got a grinning face with jewels for eyes. It's like, you know, I guess Lugosi's always got to have some kind of ring for his Dracula portrayals.
I thought it looked like the face of drama.
Yeah, it did. I thought it kind of looked like comedy and drama together or something. Dramedy, I guess. Now we get to the other actor that I know. Detective Gannett was played by an actor named William Austin. Comic connection, he was Alfred in the 1943 Batman movie serial. Mm-hmm. And the reason that Alfred went from the fat, clean-shaven version in the comics to the thin and mustachioed version that we all know today. He looks just like classic Alfred. So there you go. So there's your comic connection, even though we're not doing a Batman comic book this time. But when Gannett and the other detective, you know, question Andreas and he freaks out, wolfs out, Matt Willis runs out of the shot, and then they run over and grab him. When they pull him back in the shot, that's clearly not Matt Willis as Andreas. That's some of the stunt man. You can tell his face isn't the same.
And even the physique, his build is different.
Yeah, it's clearly not him. So I thought that was a little, you know, it's like watching an episode of Star Trek. It's like, okay, that's not William Shatner. Mm-hmm. thanks with the great, you know, the battle with Khan and Kirk. You know, it's like, oh, God, we've been on that before. But anyway, Fleet has to be the most stubborn, bullheaded policeman in the universe. How much evidence does this man need before he starts even entertaining the idea of a vampire and a werewolf? I mean, you know, give me Inspector Mulroney from last episode in The Mummy. You know, it's like he was kind of like, oh, that's pretty damn crazy. But as soon as stuff started adding up, he's like, it's crazy, but hey, here we are. You know, it's like, I mean, he was on to Bruckner, but he still, even with all the stuff going on, he didn't want to believe he was Tesla.
Right.
It's like, they talked about this guy becoming a werewolf before. They found a werewolf in the tomb. It was Andreas. Your men saw Andreas turn into a werewolf. Why don't you believe this? I know it's crazy, but so Andreas attacks Elsa, the governess, who barely has anything to do in the movie. and takes her off into another room, but we never hear any more about this.
No, I mean,
we see her later, so it's like, okay,
what did he do with her?
He didn't kill her. Did he just, like, knock her out? Did he?
Because he pulls her off scene, so.
I want to show you some clothes I brought you. Look at this bundle. We all bundle.
You're getting punchy,
I'm
dude.
Getting punchy. It's late. Nikki watching John's throat as he talks is a nice touch. It's just this close-up of his Adam's apple going up and down, like, from her perspective.
Yeah.
It's like, ugh. And especially, it's a nice, like, little... It leads you to think she bit him, but Tesla did, apparently.
Because Tesla is over in the background watching him, even though he's planning on taking Nikki as his bride, but he's watching Nikki come on to her fiancé and just I like the watch. I mean, come on. Not only is he a creeper, he, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those that just gives you the full body shiver.
Yeah, that's right. The scene with the organ is nicely done. Lugosi looks regally creepy with the light and everything there. And then, you know, this movie delves deeper into the idea of faith and goodness versus this supernatural evil, more so than the Universal films do. I mean, they use the crosses and the holy implements as a tool, but you don't really get into the faith that's behind them. And this movie does here and then definitely at the end, which I like. So it's got a little more substance than some of the Universal films, some of the later ones. Oh, yeah. So a couple things that kind of jumped out at me. So Andreas's hands stay hairy all the time.
I mean,
like, that's inconvenient.
Well, I wonder what he's been doing. So it had to be said. Sorry.
I've got some girly mags in this bundle, master.
I mean, just saying.
I can't see very well, master. I'm going blind.
God, you're getting punchy.
So another thing. Here's another thing where we're going to be really juvenile. When Nikki sits up in bed, I just noticed this. She's got this sheer nightgown, and Lady Jane, like, puts her arms on both shoulders, but she misses her shoulder at first and actually cops a feel.
She does.
And then moves her hand up. She moves her hand up real quick. And they didn't reshoot, you know. So I thought that was kind of it.
I mean, you could see her kind of like, oh, shoot.
Yeah. You know? I touched that. Whoops. Sorry about that. Whoops. Personal space. Hold on. Whoa. Creepy. I'm your mother-in-law. Future mother-in-law. Let's not do that. When I first saw this movie, and she pulls the musical notes off the organ, and the cross is there lit up,
right,
and Tesla backs away, he, like, explodes in a puff of smoke. I'm like, holy crap, she killed him. This is the end of the movie.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, Universal movies have a habit of, you know, abrupt ending. I'm like,
right,
okay, it's even though this is Columbia, they did the same thing, you know.
No, it's not but it's not the end of it.
No, so,
yeah. For the final climactic scene, Nikki, she had been putting on this striped robe through the whole movie. Every time she got up, she puts on an ethereal,
flowy
robe. So she looks, you know, more spooky as she walks through the cemetery and the woods and everything. But the ending, of course, which we detailed pretty well, is really surprising because you don't expect Andreas to be the one that stops Tesla.
I mean, he was truly redeemed.
Right, he was redeemed in the last minute. And you don't see the air raid coming that stops him either. So it's like surprise and then surprise again. And then you get the power of faith and goodness emphasized. And as we said, it's not just a tool, it's a statement. I mean, the filmmakers are saying, you know, and in those times it makes sense. I mean, because obviously...
Good will win.
Because, I mean, especially in London, you know.
Yeah, during World War II.
Yeah.
Yeah, good will win.
Right. And then Andreas drags Tesla's blown up ass out into the sun.
Yep.
He's like, I'm dying, sucker, but you're going with me. It's like, you go, boy. It's like, all right. And then he picks up a brick and, like, takes a spike. Here's the spike again, and
yep,
there he goes. The melting face of Lugosi is a really nice effect. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it actually looks better than that final phase of the Christopher Lee disintegrating, unfortunately, your Muppet face in the Horror of Dracula.
Awful.
It's unfortunate. Kirk Hammett actually has a copy of both the skull and the Lugosi head from that movie in his book.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's in his book, in his too much horror business book.
Kirk Hammett, too much horror business. Also, Metallica.
Yeah, you know. Right. That's a great book. If you're a monster fan and you haven't, I think Amazon's got that thing dirt cheap. It's like a hardcover for like $20. It's full of awesome posters, memorabilia. If you're a monster or horror movie fan, get that
strongly
book.
Strongly suggest getting it.
Get that book, definitely. The fourth wall breaking ending is kind of strange, and to me it kind of undercuts that powerful message just a little bit. It's like, I could have done without that. You know, it's like,
yeah, I mean,
again, that's Columbia hedging their bets. It's like, oh, well, I don't know if people will accept this. There's been freaking supernatural movies since Dracula came out.
Right.
I mean, The Mummy was, The Wolfman, you know, it's like, come on.
Yeah, they've been, last 10, 15 years, they're,
And it's not, there's not been a cop-out or anything, so. I really, what did you think of this movie?
I really liked it. I especially loved the character of Lady Jane. She was a wonderful, strong character. I mean, like I said at the beginning, she is one of these women. She took care of business.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and she didn't have to get saved by gum.
Yeah. No, she didn't. No, she never did. No, she even confronted the villain on her own. I mean, she had some chutzpah to do that, So good for her. Yeah. I really like it. I think this. And I love the Universal movies, don't get me wrong, but by this period, as we talked about in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, the first half of that movie is kind of the end of the more prestigious end of that series. You're with House of Frank, with the end of, as you halfway through that movie, when the Frankenstein monster comes in, and then into the House movies and the other horror-related films they're doing, you're getting into the definitely more the B-grade picture. The stories are kind of dumber,
You can tell they were rushed to get them out.
Right. They're more of just churning out sausage. This one seems, it's thoughtful. It's gotten more of a serious tone. It's obviously very topical. And I really like it. I'm glad that, it's getting, we're talking about it. But I'm glad Derek talked about it on Monster Kid Radio, too. Because I think people who haven't seen it, if you like Lugosi and Dracula, this is a great showcase for him, which he unfortunately didn't get a lot of those into the 40s. He's great in Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein. And I'd even say that this is kind of a good bridge between his original portrayal of Dracula in the first film and his kind of mad scientist Dracula in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, because he's more of a, he disguises himself as Dr. Lejos in that movie. And so there's some elements of Adam Costello Meet Frankenstein to make you think, did they watch this movie? Because he's Dr. Bruckner here, he's Dr. Lejos there, and Armon Tesla was a scientist. Uh-huh. So, it made sense that he could pull off, acting like a doctor. So it makes you kind of wonder. But yeah, this is definitely, if you haven't seen it, you like Dracula, you like Lugosi, watch this movie. I think you'll really enjoy it.
I think so, too.
So up next, we have a comic with some surprising thematic ties to this very film. And we're not going to tell you what it is. But come back.
Once upon a time, five friends who met on the Bot Talk Transformers forum set out to develop a podcast dedicated to their various interests. Transformers, science fiction, fantasy, and comic books. Part fanboys and part assholes, they came to be known as the Fanholes. Their unbridled enthusiasm for podcasting did not end there, and soon enough, their proper podcast spun off into the Fanholes network of podcasts. Besides our podcast proper, the Fanholes soon had a continuum of genre-specific, focused shows such as Mobile Suit Mondays, Transformers Tuesdays, Toku Thursdays, and Sentai Saturdays. New weekly content can be found on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and fanholespodcast.blogspot.com. Fanholes Podcast, the pop culture podcast, made for the fans, by the fans.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to go into our dusty long box one last time before we are chased out by all the monsters here in the House of Frankenstein, and we are going to cover Captain America number 253 and 254. Yeah, baby. Captain America number 253 was cover dated January 1981 and on sale October 14th, 1980. according to Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics.
The first Halloween comics on newsstand during Halloween?
Right, yeah. Woo! Well, one of the few, yeah, that's for sure. This issue was produced by the fabled Roger Stern, John Byrne creative team. They revitalized the title for a very brief period. It began in issue number 247 and ended two issues following this one, which we'll get into the why it ended later. So we'll jump straight into this. The cover by Byrne and inker Joe Rubenstein depicts Captain America entering a shadowy room. Cap is in the background and his flashlight is throwing a hint of light on a box or a coffin as a bony and sinewy arm, well actually two arms, open the lid from within. The text blurb reads, "Tomb of Blood." The background image of Cap and the room door look like they may have been reproduced directly from Byrne's pencils. It's reminiscent and evocative of similar covers that Neil Adams did for DC during the horror mystery craze that swept Marvel and DC in the early 70s. So I think it's kind of it's got that vibe about it. We open it up, the comic inside, and of course, Stan Lee presents Captain America, Should Old Acquaintance Be Forgot? Roger Stern and John Byrne, writer, co-plotters, penciler, Joe Rubenstein, inker, Jim Novak, letterer, Bob Sharon, colorist, Jim Salakrup, editor, Jim Shooter, chief.
When Captain America throws his mighty shield, all those who chose to oppose his shield must yield. If he's led to a fight and a duel is due, then the red and the white and the blue will come through when Captain America throws his mighty shield.
A rainy night in a normally quiet English village not far from the north of London. A police constable and local doctor discover a body on the grounds of the village square. This young woman appears to be the third victim of the killer known as the Slasher, who snaps his prey's neck, tears out their throat, and drains the blood. The two men inform Lady Jacqueline Crichton of their findings, and her ladyship is determined the killer be found and stopped. She pledges to contact her friends at Scotland Yard in the morning. Meanwhile, her aged and wheelchair-bound father watches on in the shadows, convinced he knows the true identity of this killer, and he also knows the one man who can possibly stop him.
That man is Captain America. After interrupting a routine store robbery, the Star-Spangled Avenger resumes his civilian guise as Steve Rogers and takes in a revival of the classic musical Oklahoma with his girlfriend, Bernie Rosenthal. Following the show, back at their apartment building, Steve and Bernie are making strides in the relationship when Steve receives a call from Jarvis, butler to the Avengers. A coded message has been sent to Avengers HQ to be delivered to Captain America only. Steve recognizes the code and the sender, Fallsworth. He quickly brushes Bernie off, telling her he must go to England, but not why. The relationship now set back several spaces. Steve is soon on a Concorde jet bound for England.
On the plane ride, he recalls his time with the wartime supergroup, the Invaders, which consisted of Captain America, his fighting partner Bucky, the Human Torch, and his sidekick Toro, and Prince Namor, the Submariner. A pair of British heroes known as Union Jack and Spitfire later joined the team. The mantle of Union Jack was actually worn by two men, Lord James Montgomery Fallsworth and his son Brian, while Spitfire was Brian's younger sister, Jacqueline. Arriving in England, Steve finds Fallsworth's manner just as he remembered it. But Jacqueline has aged at the normal pace of an average human, her superpowers long faded and not benefiting from decades of suspended animation like Steve. A slightly rattled Jackie is happy to see her old friend, and the two quickly catch up on the nearly 40 years Steve has missed out on. Jackie is now the widow of Lord Crichton, and her brother Brian died in an auto accident in the early 50s. What she doesn't know is why Steve chose to visit now. Steve assumed Jackie sent the summons, but soon finds out it was her father, Lord Fallsworth himself. The elderly but still distinguished man greets his old comrade and wastes no time in telling Steve about the murders and who he believes is behind them, their old foe and Fallsworth's own brother, Baron Blood.
Jackie attempts to reason with her father, citing Scotland Yard believes the killer to be a vampire copycat, and that the real Baron Blood's remains are still entombed in the Tower of London. But Lord Fallsworth is not convinced. He laments the crown not allowing him to put a permanent end to Blood's evil years ago by the only true way to permanently destroy a vampire, decapitation. Jackie is dismissive of her father's theories, citing senility, but Steve has faith in his old friend and vows to look into his suspicions.
As Captain America, he and the constable visit with Dr. Cromwell, who has been involved in the case thus far. The enthusiastic doctor relates to Cap that he saw him during the war, but his awestruck reaction turns sour when Cap mentions the word vampire. He kicks the hero out of his office, decrying the notion as lunacy. Outside, the constable informs Cap that the doctor is very sensitive about the subject of vampires. Not long after Cromwell arrived in the village, a vampire scare spread throughout the town. The villagers believe they had chased Dracula into Cromwell's home. The frightened mob set fire to his house as an arriving Cromwell rushed in to save his daughter, who the crowd didn't know was inside. He was unfortunately too late. His daughter passed away, and he himself suffered major burns, which left him scarred. While Cap is sympathetic, he knows vampires are real, and so his search continues at the Tower of London.
Scotland Yard's Inspector Sweeney takes Cap to a secret room in the tower, covered in garlic and religious iconography. Inside lies the coffin of Baron Blood, his noble heritage stalling any action to completely destroy his body. Cap and Sweeney find what appears to be the Baron's body inside, with a stake protruding from his ribcage. Cap removes the stake, much to Sweeney's horror. But Cap knows this is not Baron Blood. In fact, this is the body of a woman, which a coroner soon confirms as having been deceased for at least 12 years. Baron Blood may or may not be the slasher, but he's been loose upon the world again for over a decade.
The Sentinel of Liberty returns to Fallsworth Manor and there meets Jackie's son, Kenneth, and his roughly hewn friend from art school, Joey Chapman, whom Jackie doesn't care for. Conferring again with Lord Fallsworth, Cap tells his old friend that he believes Blood is most likely the slasher, despite the rest of the family's incredulous attitude. He vows to stay at Fallsworth Manor until the killer is found.
That night, the gargoyle-like figure of Baron Blood crawls about the outside of the manor until finding the sleeping Captain America in the very guest room he frequented during the war. Blood slides through the open window and prepares to snap the neck of his hated foe, until Cap rises up and smashes his fanged face with his indestructible shield. Cap admits he knew Blood would come and set himself up as an easy target. A battle between the two ensues, with Cap quickly remembering Blood's superhuman strength. The Avenger manages to put a loop of garlic around Blood's bony neck, but the vampire vanishes into mist. After getting the drop on Cap, their tussle continues throughout the manor as they awaken the rest of the household. The Baron uses his vampiric powers to command an army of rats to converge on the manor.
The combatants finally tumble into Lord Fallsworth's room, who awakens to see his demonic brother using his hypnotic power on Cap. With the hero entranced, Baron Blood slithers up Cap's rigid form. Kenneth and Jackie rush into the room just as Blood bares his fangs and begins to doom Captain America to an eternity of damnation as a vampire.
Okay, let's get this out of the way. I love this story. So there's going to be a lot of gushing involved on my end, at least. But let's get to the nitty-gritty. I really like the cover. It's very moody. It really does remind me of comics like from about 10 years before. And more of a DC comic than a Marvel, because their covers were more bombastic, more blurbs, more balloons. They had that god-awful, ugly border frame thing that was going on in their covers. The main part of the cover was like a box in the middle, like in the lower middle of the cover, and then the top was just for, you know, it was like a color band, and then, you know, it was like very rigid. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they did that. They must have had some they're talking about that on the Fantastic Cast right now, because they're in that era on that show, and but this look reminds me more of a DC type cover. Just get it out of the way. This is John Byrne at the top of his game. He's got a great inker in Rubenstein, so you're going to get excellent art. I mean, you know, there's no point in just keep gushing about it. The art's great. I mean, it's top of the line comic book superhero artwork. The splash page sets the mood of the story very well. You get that shadowy, rainy feeling. I mean, you can just feel the rain. You can just feel the cold. It's very Tomb of Dracula-like, which makes sense. I think it's interesting, you don't know to look for it, but you can see Dr. Cromwell's scars on page 2, but they don't leap out at you, because he's got a beard.
Right.
But he's got, you know, it's the at right about where his beard starts to grow on his cheeks, he's got scars
mm-hmm.
from the fire. So, Yeah, I really like that we quickly see meet Jackie, and Lord Falsworth is, you know, off in the shadows. But I did notice one thing. He's up on the, like, second floor stairway, and he's in a wheelchair, and there's no banister right in front of him.
No, there's no railing.
There's no railing.
Just a little ledge there.
Just a little ledge. That's kind of dangerous for in any house, let alone if you've got a somebody in a wheelchair in the house. I thought that kind of, that might have been Burns' way of just, I want to show this guy's in a wheelchair. I also want to show the other people on the lower floor talking to show that he's observing them. And it was a little bit of a visual cheat. But, you know, that was like one of the few things that kind of jumped that I called foul on. We largely skipped over the robbery scene in the book, in the synopsis, just because it's not really pertinent to the story.
Main story, but it's nice character work.
Yeah, it's a nice bit of character work because Cap actually convinces the guy to hand over his gun.
Well, and he was like, now, son, you know, just like...
Yeah, exactly. Very Chris Evans. Yeah. Which, you know, just proves how great he is.
And that's who I heard in my head.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. We'll get back into that later, but yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, it's, you just don't get that in comics nowadays. They're so busy with making everything, you know, everything's got to be connected. Everything's got to point toward that trade. You don't get these little moments like this anymore. You know, while reading this, and we also skipped over the fact that, you know, Captain America's, you know, he goes back to the rooftop. He turns back into Steve Rogers. He puts his shield into an art portfolio. And because he's a freelance artist, freelance graphic artist. And I never had thought of that before, but that might be, you know, one that might have influenced my career path. Because that's what I do in my day job. I like how Steve thinks when they're going to see Oklahoma, he's like, well, I saw it. Yeah, I've seen it before, but he didn't tell her. I saw it in 1943.
When it first came out.
Yeah, that's right. It's a classic? Oh, well, I thought it was still new. Actually, Bernie was Cap's girlfriend for most of the 80s, like up until the late 80s. She kind of faded out of the book. She debuted in Stern and Burns' first issue, which, as we said, was number 247. I like the fact, you know, Steve doesn't really lie to Bernie, but he doesn't tell her why he's going to England. He just says, I've got to go to England. And he ends their date really quick. But she kind of does him dirty by saying, oh, well, I've got a old boyfriend coming into town anyway.
I don't know if that's necessarily doing him dirty. He just brushed her off the date, so she wants to get her own dig in. All right, you're going to leave a date? Well, guess what, buddy? I ain't going to wait around for you.
See, I consider that kind of dirty.
No.
Well, she regrets it as soon as she does it.
I know, outside, but still yet, I can see why she would do it.
Well, I mean, you know, but yeah, I mean, that. I mean, it's very
human. Not dirty.
Well, it's not dirty, but it's a little underhanded. How's that? Because, you know, I like that. And again, that's something you don't get nowadays. I mean, you're not going to get little subplotty character moments like that. I mean, that's just... They had a lot of, you know, they'd make some progress and then they'd lose ground and then they'd make a little more progress and they'd lose a bit of... And it was always something to do with his life as Captain America. I mean, it's typical comic book superhero romance conflict, but you just don't even get that type of stuff anymore. The civilian lives of the superheroes, they've all but erased them, you know, which is a shame. Now on the plane, we get a nice flashback to the Invader series of the mid to late 70s where Union Jack, Spitfire, and Baron Blood... all debuted in issue number 7 in one form or another. They weren't all in costume.
But. And let's talk about this plane ride.
Okay.
He talks about he had to empty out his savings account to go do this.
Yes.
He's freaking Captain America, which is, like I asked you, you know, this is funded by Tony freaking billionaire Stark.
Yeah.
Does he not get a salary for being Captain America? I mean, I have yet to figure that out, how heroes can work, be funded, just like, you know, on the JLA cartoon, you know, Bruce Timm, you've got,
Martian Manhunter?
No. Green Lantern.
John Stewart?
Yes, thank you. I had the wrong first name. John Stewart, he's living in this little slummy apartment, but couldn't Bruce Wayne give them all a salary of some kind? So that they didn't have to have a day job? I mean, that is just stupid. That's like, you know, firefighters. They don't have other stuff. They are supposed to be there. They're supposed to be fresh so that they can face the fires that they're going to fight. That's what? Well, that makes no sense, and it's a problem in the comic book universe. As far as if you have an organized team that is backed by a freaking billionaire, whether it be Bruce Wayne with JLA or whether it be the Avengers with Tony Stark, it's the whole part of, you know, firefighters shouldn't have to, you know, you want them fresh to enable to fight fires. Same thing with superheroes.
Well, I think later they do say something about the Avengers. The Avengers actually do have like a small salary at some point that they pay them, like just basically to, you know, I mean, they don't make a lot of money, but just to live on. And I think later when they had Justice League International, I think they got paid. I think they had like a salary, or they could live at the embassy or whatever. And some of them did. That's all foggy in my head. But the thing that gets me that now I understand that's a greater concern of, you know, of the whole concept of superheroes. But particularly for this story, Cap says that the coded message said to come incognito. So that's why he flies as Steve Rogers.
But still.
Hold on. I'm not done.
Okay.
So he even says, I could have taken an Avengers Quinjet, but it said to go incognito. But he comes to the manor as Steve Rogers. He meets Jackie. He meets Lord Fallsworth. The rest of the story, he's Captain America.
And when he goes through the customs line, so they won't go through his stuff, he shows that he's Captain America.
Right.
So if the customs agent could have said, hey, Captain America arrived on English soil.
Yeah.
News at 11.
Right, right.
Sell the story to the nearest tabloid.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I really don't understand. I think maybe the only reason they did it was so Steve would show up, so Cap would show up in his Steve Rogers guise when he met Jackie, so you would get that she's aged, he's not more, because if he was in costume, you know, the visual wouldn't work quite as well, maybe. But all he had to do was come in as Cap, park the Quinjet, you know, on a moor somewhere and change into Steve and walk out, mm-hmm. You know, which that's the one part of this story that's kind of like, I think that might have just been another Marvelism. It was more of a, you know, all the Marvel superheroes had problems. I mean, that was the thing that made them different. So, you know, it's like, ooh, Cap, you know, blowing all of his money to make it to England to help out an old buddy makes him more Marvel-like, makes him more relatable, more human, you know, than I'm hopping in my, you know, space jet that's funded by my buddy in the, you know, armored suit and flying over. But I don't think it really works. Yeah, I agree. It's one thing that jumps out at
me.
Let's
put a pin in that idea and move on to the next topic.
Right, okay. Of course, Jackie is concerned that she looks so old compared to Steve. That's a nice touch. I mean, she's like trying to, she's out gardening too when he walks up on her. So she's not at her best anyway. She was probably, you know, in her late 50s, early 60s by this point. Because this is, you know, 1980, 1981. So I think it really gets me through this story. And it has to be that way to work. And don't get me wrong. Like I said, I love this story. But Steve is the only one who really believes Lord Fallsworth. The rest of the family thinks he's senile or at least irrational. Considering that they all fought Baron Blood, and we'll get into how related Jackie was to the whole Baron Blood affair, it's kind of hard to imagine why she in particular is being so pig-headed. You know, that'd be the first thing I think anybody in that family would think of. It's like, okay, it's a vampire-like killer. Why wouldn't you assume it was Baron Blood in your town, where your manor is, where he's from, his hometown? There's a vampire-like killer killing people in a vampire-like manner, and your uncle is a vampire. It's like...
Right, exactly.
Why? And I know he's in the Tower of London, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, well, whatever. He's a vampire, you know? I mean, they know that vampires... You know,
exist. Right.
They pull tricks. He could have gotten loose. You know, I just, you know, that part was like, just like, okay, how dense are you? But then, if they could have figured all that out, then they wouldn't have needed Captain America to come, and it wouldn't have fit into his book. So, as related in this story, you can understand why Dr. Cromwell would flip out over the mention of a vampire.
Right. I also wonder though why Cromwell decided to stay within the town where his daughter was attacked.
Yeah.
I mean, most people would move on.
Maybe we'll find out in part two.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Baron Blood lying in state at the Tower of London makes perfect sense in the Marvel universe, you know. So, you know, how would you destroy a royal vampire, right? You actually brought up a better point than I was going to make. I was going to think, well, it makes you think of, like, you know, that theory that Jack the Ripper was like a cousin of royalty that they...
But with Elizabeth Bathory, she, that is the whole reason she was convicted of killing anywhere from 80 to hundreds of young girls.
Like 600, I heard one time.
Well, but they were able to confirm 80.
Yeah.
So, and because I just read a recent biography of her. And reading through that, that was the reason she was put in life imprisonment.
She was walled up into
She was walled up into two or three rooms in one of her castles because she was nobility.
Yeah.
The ladies, her ladies in waiting that helped her and the man that helped her, he was torn apart.
Yeah.
They tore him apart. The women, their fingers were pulled off with pincers.
Yeah.
And then they were put to the stake and burned alive.
Wow.
So, and that was pretty much immediately within the trial. And then she was walled up and she lived, I think, for another 4 years following the trial.
Wow. And that went on for years, that whole case, didn't it?
No, it was relatively quick.
Really?
They came and came to her, well, they collected evidence for a while because her main accuser was actually one of her old lovers. And he was like, you know, whoa, wait a minute. After her husband passed away, who was also sadistic in his own right, she found a lover, which was his best friend. And at that time, they were both free, and they were moving towards possibly getting married, and he came and visited at the castle, and he's like, whoa. He didn't want any part of it. And he was like, and he started a relationship with somebody else, and he sent her to help collect evidence under the guise of, you know, just wanting to learn from the wonderful woman. And also she was a younger girl and, you know. Which just fueled her hatred even more. But it was a fascinating story. He collected evidence against her. And there was also some facts that by collecting the evidence against her, they were able to seize her property. Because she was a widow, she was able to control her own property. And at that time period, men did not want women having that much power. But because she was nobility, they couldn't put her to death.
For oddly enough, some of the stuff you just mentioned, and I've read books about her. I've seen, you know, documentaries and things, and, you know, reenactments and things. But oddly enough, some of the what you mentioned actually is in Countess Dracula, the Hammer film.
With
Ingrid Pitt, although she actually de-ages, you know, on screen. She's got old makeup, and then she, you know, which, you know, like Ingrid, we talked about Ingrid Pitt in the first episode of House of Frankenstein this year, so, which that's a good movie, by the way, if it's kind of a little bit different than your usual Hammer, because you're not getting into the well, obviously you're getting to some aspect of the supernatural vampire, but you're not getting into the bats and the,
you're
changing to bats and things like that, so it's kind of interesting. But yeah, good point. This is kind of this whole Baron.
Well, in this particular book, it doesn't say anything about her trying to remain young.
Oh, really?
This is about her in her mind, and it follows her from her childhood all the way up through her death.
Yeah.
And she, you can see, looking back on it and knowing how it ends up, you can say, oh, you know, in her childhood, different indicators about how she was not right. And I mean, just...
So she wasn't trying to, according to this, she wasn't trying to stay young? Was she drinking blood?
No. According to this particular book, what it was is she was obsessed with that everybody be loyal, obedient, and virtuous. So if she had women come to her household, if they were found to have had intercourse or if they were found to be possibly, quote-unquote, stealing from her or if they spoke against her in any form or fashion, they were sent to be punished, or she meted out the punishment herself.
Well, it's not nearly as interesting if she's not bathing in blood. Sorry.
I mean, this is that particular...
I know. I gotcha.
And that's the reason she... But they said that was the reason she went after younger girls, because she thought, I want to be young, but it wasn't... All of it was they want to be virtuous, and they want to be well-learned and all of that stuff.
Okay, well, we better get back to Baron Blood.
Sorry.
Okay, so Cap knew the body was of a woman and not blood, just because of his experiences in the war, he looked at it and said, that's a woman, you know, and he had every confidence to remove the stake because he knew it wasn't a man.
But the only thing about that, because when he was in combat, wouldn't he have come upon bodies that had been recently deceased and not skeletons?
Well, not necessarily.
Well, I mean, you know, that was one thing that I was just like...
Yeah, I thought that was another nice little character.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's just one thing that I thought, well, yes, in traditional combat, where he would be coming upon a recent scene of carnage, but would it be one that had already gone to skeletal remains?
Gotcha, yeah. I don't know, but I thought that was a nice little thing. Cap goes back to the manor, and we meet Kenneth and Joey, and Jackie doesn't care much for Joey, and Kenneth says it's due to his lower class heritage. But if you read this chapter, you kind of start to wonder what exactly their relationship is. I mean, it, to me, it's kind of like, it's not that, because in part two, we find out something else that we don't know
right now. Right.
But because comics back then would be super, super subtle with things like that. I mean, they would occasionally put little things like that in there, and you could kind of like, but, you know. Oddly enough, though, while I was researching this, when I, researching the Fallsworths and Baron Blood and Union Jack and all that stuff, and according to one of the Marvel wikis, Brian, the second Union Jack, was actually retconned into having a relationship with another Invaders created character named Dynamite. So apparently Brian was gay. So who knew? I didn't know. But anyway. Which, you know, retcons, I mean, the Invaders themselves are retcons. There was no actual Invader series in World War II. That was Roy Thomas saying that there were all those covers of Cap, Submariner, and Human Torch fighting together, but they didn't actually put him on a team until, like, at the end of the, like, right after the war, there was a book called All Winners Comics, and for two issues, they had the All Winners Squad. And so that was when, you know, and actually Bill Finger wrote one of those stories. They didn't have a Justice Society of America, you know. So that was his way of creating, you know, giving them a name, and they had adventures that were, they were actually teammates, you know. So even with it confirmed that Baron Blood must be loose, the Fallsworths, they still are considering Lord Fallsworth senile.
Right.
I mean,
I'm just like, What do you want?
What do you want? Captain America just told you, it ain't Baron Blood. He, you know, it's been confirmed. It's a woman's body, and they're like, your grandpa's senile. It's like, oh, I don't say that about him, but I hate to see him this way. It's not like, shut up. No, he's not senile. He's right. You know, it's like, oh, poor grandpa. He's gone nuts. You know?
I know. Well, think about that. His family's just like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So when we finally see Baron Blood, he is. You know, of course, he's portrayed very creepy. He's very lithe and creepy looking. He's almost spider-like. And the first shot we see, he's like a gargoyle, you know, perched on top of the manor. And he crawls down the castle wall.
Right, much like in Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's, because, you know, it shows him crawling
down.
Yeah,
but that's from the book.
I know, but I'm saying as far as visual, that's what it brought to mind.
Yeah, and it's straight out of Stoker, so. Yeah. And I've always liked his design because it's a perfect mesh of vampire and supervillain without evoking Batman too much. Maybe very early Batman.
Right.
But it's that, like, you know, it's like a jump. He doesn't like, oh, that looks like Batman. He looks like a bat, and but he doesn't look like Batman, which is not easy, you know, to do. The fight with him and Cap's well choreographed.
Oh, it is. I love that.
Yeah. Especially when he slams him in the face with his shield. that's nice. And then you get that cliffhanger. Now, that's a hell of a cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's get into issue number two. Captain America number 254 was dated February 1982, on sale November 11th, 1980. So, actually, Return of the Vampire came out November 11th, 1943.
Mm-hmm.
This comic came out November 11th, 1980.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. Another connection.
Nice kismet.
Yep. So, the cover shows Cap on one knee as Baron Blood leaps upon him. In the background, a thin and feeble Union Jack rises from his wheelchair. The background is a nice two-color treatment. It shows the room in a pale green and the window panes of Fallsworth Manor in yellow. There's no inks or anything on the cover.
Right, I mean, it just gives
it's
you...
just a visual. It's just, this is a room. It's you can tell it's in a nice manor or not, you know, because it's got these really tall, thin windows, arched windows. the blurb reads, "To battle barren blood." And the title of the story is Blood on the Moors. And the credits are the same as the previous issue, except the letterer is now Joe Rosen.
Barren blood bites deep into the neck of Captain America and screams and holds his mouth in pain. The chainmail of his uniform has saved the Star-Spangled Avenger and awoken him from his induced trance. Their battle resumes with a headstrong Kenneth entering the fray and quickly being overwhelmed by his unholy great-uncle. Barren Blood notices the rising sun and changes into the form of a bat to flee its rays and his foes. Cap is startled by this transformation, believing Nazi experimentation during the war had erased the Baron's full vampiric powers in return for solar protection.
When Joey arrives after the ruckus is over, Cap is suspicious. The young man doesn't cotton to the idea of being compared to an undead Nazi and foolishly tries to pick a fight with a living legend. Kenneth vouches that his friend is just a sound sleeper and not the pawn of a vampire.
The two young men discuss the Fallsworth's strange and tragic history. When their father died in the days before the First World War, James Montgomery became the new Lord Fallsworth. His bitter younger brother, John, headed out to find his own fortune. Instead, he ventured to Transylvania and found Dracula himself. Trying to use the Lord of the Undead's power for his own means, he instead became his victim and one of his undead legion. Dracula sent Fallsworth back to England to torment the family of Dracula's longtime foes, the Harkers. When World War I began, he became an agent of the German Kaiser known as Baron Blood, while his brother fought for England as Union Jack. Years later, he aligned himself with Hitler's Third Reich. The Baron infiltrated Fallsworth Manor, posing as his own son, and soon victimized his own niece with his bite. Why doesn't she believe what's going on? Only a blood transfusion from the android invader, the Human Torch, saved her, but it also gifted her with super speed, which she used as a heroic Spitfire. In their final battle, Union Jack's legs were crushed, but his vampire brother was staked on a jagged stalagmite. Jackie's brother, Brian, carried on their father's legacy until his untimely death, and her powers gradually faded with time. Despite his grandfather's desires, Kenneth's heart isn't into assuming the mantle of Union Jack.
Meanwhile, Baron Blood flees to a cottage on the other side of the village. There he removes his costume and puts on another disguise to help him against the sun's rays. A padded undershirt and a specially constructed life mask that resembles Dr. Cromwell.
Ta-da.
As Cromwell, he greets one of his regular patients, who is complaining of continuing nightmares and fatigue. The jovial doctor invites the young lady in for breakfast.
With the Slasher, now unilaterally known as Baron Blood, Captain America organizes a massive search for the monster with the aid of Scotland Yard, the local police, and even Kenneth and Joseph. A bitter Lord Fallsworth watches, unable to help, his final battle with his immortal brother stolen from him. Cap and his allies search the whole town, from all the homes to the caves on its outskirts. They question all the villagers on the whereabouts of this undead beast and find nothing. Taking a break at the local pub, Kenneth and Joey talk about their efforts with Jenny, the doctor's patient we met before. Kenneth, who swears he will marry the girl someday, is concerned with her health, but Jenny assures them it's just a touch of anemia. As if on cue, the girl faints before the two lads, and when they remove the choker around her neck, they find two puncture wounds. Well, of course, the mark of the vampire.
Cap returns to Fallsworth Manor to find Lord James dressed in his old Union Jack uniform. The aged hero plans to use himself as bait to lure his accursed brother out. He knows he has little chance of surviving and tells Cap it will be up to him to end his misery should Blood succeed in biting him. Cap tries to convince his old friend this is a bad idea and that he can protect him, but Union Jack will not have it, refusing to let anyone else die at the hands of his brother. Jackie overhears the power in her father's voice, something she hasn't heard since her brother Brian died. But she knows her father can't be Union Jack again, no more than she can be Spitfire as she stares at her old, vacant uniform.
Jackie confronts her father and demands he stop his charade. As Lord Fallsworth launches into a speech about their family taking care of their own black sheep, he suffers a heart attack, much to the horrified eyes of Cap and Jackie. Dr. Cromwell is summoned and finds his patient dressed in the colors of the British flag. Jackie laments that her father insisted on wearing it, but the doctor understands. He asks Cap and Jackie to leave the room for his examination. As soon as the door closes, the Doctor removes his mask in disguise and stands revealed as Baron Blood.
The vampire launches into a monologue explaining how his long-term plan has finally come to fruition, how the real Dr. Cromwell, who under the control of his master Dracula, removed the stake from his heart in the Tower of London, resurrecting him. Blood then used Cromwell to gain information but ultimately killed both him and his daughter and assumed the doctor's guise. How he had sustained himself on anemic patients until recently, when his bloodlust got the better of him. He gloats about how he actually prolonged his brother's life just to have the perfect moment to strike. As he prepares to recruit Union Jack to the ranks of the undead, the hero rises from his bed and slashes at the monster with a silver dagger.
Union Jack leaps from the bed, kicking the foul vampire right in the face. The Baron is briefly flummoxed by his brother's mobility, but soon surmises a third man has donned the mantle of Union Jack. As their battle intensifies, Captain America bursts through the locked door shield first. The two flag-draped heroes tag-team the monster, with Cap explaining how they surmised his identity when the Baron victimized Kenneth's girlfriend. Blood attempts to escape, vowing to return to the manor and turn all of its occupants into his undead army as he flies away. But Cap's ricocheting shield hits its mark and grounds him. Union Jack moves in for the kill with his silver dagger, but is unprepared for the vampire's bestial fury, and in a moment's hesitation, Blood is on top of him.
The ever-resourceful Cap pulls down the large curtains in the room, allowing the rays of the sun to penetrate. A raving mad Baron refused to let this stop him, as he knows the sun is setting and soon he will be at full power. He leaps upon Captain America, but the quick reflexes of the Avenger turn the table, and soon Cap is on top of his foe. Blood's talon-like fingers clawing at his uniform, ripping it to shreds, Captain America feels the vampire's strength growing as the sun rapidly sets. He remembers Lord Falsworth's words about the only way to destroy a vampire. Knowing what he must do, despite the personal horror of it, Captain America raises his shield above his head and swiftly brings it down upon the vampire's neck, decapitating him with a sickening sound as a startled Union Jack watches.
Cap bears witness to the vampire's destruction, his aged body turning into that of a long-dead skeleton. As Jackie and Kenneth enter the room, Union Jack unmasks to reveal the face of Joey Chapman. Both Joey and Kenneth agree that it was best for Chapman to assume the role of Union Jack, bloodline or not. His friends are concerned for the obviously shaken Cap, but Joey assures them he'll be all right despite the terrible task he was forced to perform.
Later, on the snowy moors near Falsworth Manor, Cap, Joey, Kenneth, Jackie, and Lord Falsworth watch as the final remains of James Falsworth, aka Baron Blood, are burned in two separate fires. When Kenneth tells his grandfather it is finally over, he cannot hear him. Lord Falsworth is dead. His weak heart finally given out, with his mission finally completed and his brother's reign of evil over at last. A solemn group rolls the hero's lifeless body back to his family home as an image of Union Jack symbolically floats in the skies above them. I'm sorry, I had to read the part where he decapitates Baron Blood.
I know, I was starting going through the synopsis and Chris is like laying his hand on top of the paper and I'm like, what? Oh, I know what it is. I'm like, okay. He's like stopping me. I'm like, okay, I get it. You want the glory. You get to do the chunk thing.
Hey, yeah. I gotta do chunk. I gotta get that sound effect from Tom and Jerry cartoon.
Yeah.
Chunk. We'll get to that. We're going to get to that. So on page one, we got the splash with Baron Blood crawling up Cap's body, full body shot of Cap as Baron Blood crawls up him. Then on page two, we get a flashback from the
previous issue.
Previous issue, in case anybody missed it. You know, we talked about when we did The Adventures of Captain America about Cap's, Kevin Maguire drew it as scale mail. And, you know, most people drew it as chainmail before. This is probably the first time that Cap's chainmail actually did something. You know, mm-hmm. They actually came in handy because he bites his neck and, it almost breaks his teeth. You know,
that's really cool.
Yeah, it's cool. Jeff Nettleton, if you're listening, you probably know what, you know, if Cap's chainmail ever helped him out before. Let us know. I'm serious. I know Jeff will know this. He can let us know.
Okay.
You got to give Kenneth credit. I mean, he goes in swinging, trying to help out. You know, he doesn't, but, you know, at least he does, which is kind of surprising considering he says he doesn't want anything to do with being a superhero, but he still tries, you know.
Right.
So you got it. He's not. I like that. He might not want to be a superhero. He's not a wimp either.
No.
I mean, he's not a coward. He tries to save Cap, protect his grandfather and his mother. Stern references that the Nazis experimented on Baron Blood to enhance his ability to withstand the sun, but that it had robbed him of some of his classical vampire powers. You know, they could have just left that out, but back then, Marvel was very tight with continuity. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it was published and you're using this character, you're going to have to bring it up.
I mean, they were.
So, and Stern was really always good about that. You know, you really can't blame Cap for suspecting Joy.
Right.
But you also can't blame Joy for getting mad about it.
Right. And also, Cap just comes right out, hey, I think you might be it. You know, let's talk, yeah. You know.
It's like, you might be a vampire or a pawn of a vampire. You know, it's like.
Not real subtle.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look what he's wearing. The guy's not subtle.
Well,
yeah.
This is true.
We get nearly 2 pages of flashback, which I'm thankful for, because I still haven't read the original Baron Blood stories from the Invaders. And at this point, all I had to go on was the official Marvel Handbook entries and this comic. I have several issues of the Invaders, but I don't have these because they're early in the run. I need to comb the back issue bins or get an essential volume or something. So, I've always thought this was interesting. Spitfire gets super speed powers from a transfusion from the Human Torch.
Okay. He's an android.
He's an android that bursts into flame. You know, he's a...
And why does an android have blood?
Well, I guess he's kind of like a synthoid or whatever they call it. Kind of like...
Okay.
He's kind of like the Vision, you know? Because actually, at one point, the Human Torch was supposed to be... The Vision was supposed to be the Human Torch's body.
Mm.
They were the same body. But that Ultron had used the, like, brain patterns of, like, Wonder Man. And it's confusing as all hell. And then they were, and then they weren't. And then they were again, and then they weren't again. I don't know. But anyway, it's as crazy as it is for a, you know, okay, if you say the Human Torch has blood, okay. It gives her a transfusion. Okay, you know, when Bruce Banner gave his cousin Jennifer a transfusion, she became She-Hulk.
Uh-huh.
So if Spitfire became like a flaming character.
Right.
Why'd she get super speed?
No.
Although it's better than the Invader's teammate, the Wizard, who wears a yellow costume. The Wizard.
Let that sink in.
Let that sink in.
Oh, dear.
He got his super speed. He was basically Marvel's version of the Flash. He got his super speed, or Timely's. He got his super speed from a transfusion of mongoose blood or a bite or something. It was something to do with mongooses.
So, I'm wearing a very puzzled expression on this. What?
Yes.
Okey-dokey.
And tying into the Vision, at one time they thought the Wizard and Miss America were the parents of another Invader's teammate, were the parents of the Vision, Scarlet Witch, Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, before they knew it was Magneto. So, yeah, crazy. Again, like you brought up, let's reiterate, why did Jackie have such a hard time believing Blood may be the Slasher? She was actually bitten by Baron Blood.
Herself!
And it's her uncle. Come on, lady. You know? I mean, geez. I thought it was kind of interesting, you know, when you're reading this. Had you read this before?
No.
You had never read this before?
No.
So, did you know that Cromwell was Baron Blood? Were you surprised by that?
Well, I figured it out before they actually showed it.
Okay.
Probably just like a page or two ahead, because I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, well, I kind of was wondering about it when they showed that Baron Blood wasn't in the tomb and that said it was 12 years previous. And I was like, wait a minute, as far as timeline, and it was a young woman, I bet you that's his daughter's body.
Yeah, they don't ever come out and say that, but
yeah, but
I'm
like, wait a minute, I bet you that's his body, and if that's the case, I wonder if that's him, you know, and that's when I figured, I was thinking that, and then this confirmed it.
Right.
So that's when, you know, when they showed it in the tomb, and they said it was a woman's body, and it's been there 12 years, I'm like, oh, wait a minute, I bet you that's what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I just didn't know, because
I don't remember
if I was shocked, it's been so long, I didn't buy this off the stand, I missed these, but I bought them sometime in the like late 80s when I started going to comic shops a lot. So I've had them for, you know, almost 30 years. So
Yeah, but that's when I thought, oh, and then, you know.
It does kind of surprise me, though, that they go ahead and tell you that it's Cromwell rather than have him when he goes into his, you know, into his room. That they let you know before Cap knows. But then I guess it kind of, I guess they don't, you know, they're going to do the bait and switch on you with the Union Jacks.
Right.
So they don't want that reveal coming in that scene. It's like, aha! And then, aha! You know, right. It's like, so they kind of pace it out, which that just shows how good Roger Stern is. You know?
Right.
And John Byrne. I don't know which one came up because they both plotted it, so.
But I do have one problem with that when you get down to the reveal.
Okay.
Because Cromwell, you know, he's acting like he's, you know, Baron, you know, Blair and Blood is Cromwell, and he's acting like he's all nice and everything, but mm-hmm. he's like, I'm going to examine him myself, and they fall out, but he slams the door.
Right.
Why would you slam the door if you wanted some time to monologue with your victim? Because yeah. wouldn't him slamming the door kind of tip the scales? That's one thing. I'm sorry.
That's that Marvel manner back then. Everything everybody did in a Marvel book was dramatic. I mean, everything was.
I know, but I mean, that doesn't make sense character he was portraying at that point.
You're right. He would slowly shut the door, and it, you know, you could imagine that he would walk up to him and he would like start talking to him low, and then he'd get more excited as he revealed him, revealed his
so
secret.
The slamming of the door, I'm like, oh honey, you just telegraphed that you're a bad guy.
That kind of, that when you said that, that made me think of course, me being an artist and everything, I still have my copy of the How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way, and they would show, you know, this is how you don't show Doctor Strange walking into a room, and it's just a very, you know, he's walking into a, you know, it's a side shot of a room and he's walking through the door. No, they show Doctor Strange walking into a room where the camera's like looking up at him. And,
right.
You know, it's this worm's eye view of him just walking into a room. Everything's dramatic in a Marvel comic. So I think that's what it was more than anything.
But, yeah, but.
Yeah, I know, but I understand. Yeah. Getting back to where we were before, we find out that Kenneth is dating Jenny, and we actually did see Jenny.
Uh-huh.
In the previous issue, but I just couldn't figure out where to put it in the synopsis without, like, super
telegraphing
too much. So I just let, and she doesn't say anything. He just says, oh, I'm sure you'll be all right, dear. Just take your iron supplements or
something. Yeah, and she said that, and I'm like, and she has a choker on. And I'm like, eh.
Yeah, I just wonder if her head didn't fall off when the choker.
Yeah.
So, again, Kenneth is dating Jenny, so that kind of squashes that thing with him and Joey, the theory.
Yeah, but I just think that, I don't think that was necessary to say that, you know, because, well, he's got a friend from the wrong side of the tracks and he's going to marry a girl that's beneath him. He just likes to slum it.
Yeah.
You
know? He's an earthy guy, you know. Yeah. He's not into this blue blood.
And he's an art student, you know.
He's not a blue blood. Yeah, I mean, it kind of fits. He's an art student. That's probably something they didn't want him to get into, you know, and so, you know, he's just not into the whole blue blood thing, you know, but.
They could have just said that, oh, hi, Jenny, how you been? I haven't, seen you for a while, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, for them to be romantically linked was a connection that didn't really necessarily have to be there. It could have just been, oh, this is somebody I knew growing up.
He could be, like, flirtatious with her, but not to the point where they're, like, really dating or something.
And he says he's going to marry her, and I'm just like.
But although she does, it kind of makes you wonder, maybe they're really not. I mean, I guess they are kind of semi-serious, but they could almost just be, you know, I'm going to marry you someday. And she's like, oh, yeah, right. You know,
your
like,
mother would never allow
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and, you know, I hear that from every other guy that comes in here, you know.
I don't know. It depends. See, that's the thing about reading something versus hearing it. You can't hear tone of voice, which would convey
yeah, that's true.
Meaning. So
we skipped over. There's a one-page interlude back in New York with, no, I'm just in the synopsis we did. With Bernie involving, it's a scene with Bernie and another lady that lives in their apartment building. They pick up the phone and Steve's getting a irate call from a guy that had a freelance job for him. It wasn't important to the plot, so I didn't mention it until now I did, so I mentioned it.
Just to say, you know, we did.
Yeah. Lord Fallsworth's got some stones. You know, he doesn't care if he dies.
No, he figures he's going to die soon anyway,
yeah,
so why not?
Yeah. He knows Cap won't let him become a vampire. He's going to, you know, end his brother one way or the other. I do have to wonder, how'd he get dressed? You know, I mean, how'd he get in all that tight-fitting uniform without, you know.
Let it go.
Okay. All right.
It's in the script.
Okay.
This coming from Logic Glass. Let it go.
Yeah. Wow, that's new. you know, the Baron monologues a bit when he reveals all the hows and whys, but he kind of has to, so we'll be up to speed. And
he's a
melodramatic villain, so he's allowed to be, you know, to monologue. You know, of course, we described the fight pretty well, so we're kind of jumping ahead in that area, but couldn't help but think when Cap pulls the curtains down, was that a callback to Horror of Dracula? Mm. Peter Cushing, you know, pulling the curtains down in the dramatic fashion, you know, which, you know, that's awesome, which we covered last year, Ask Frankenstein. Okay, now we got all that out of the way. Let's talk about the moment, one of the coolest, most jaw-droppingly shocking, but awesome, satisfying moments in all the comics when Captain America decapitates Baron Blood.
Which I wasn't even allowed to read the synopsis of.
Okay, we're in depth here. The layout and the pacing of this, to me, is just genius. You have the first panel of the page where Cap smacks Blood in the back of the neck with his shield and gets him on the ground. And in panel two, he has him on the ground. He's on top of him. Panel three through five in the center strip, it shows the camera pulls in tighter and tighter in each panel on Cap as he realizes what he's got to do. And the color goes from normal to a deeper shade of red and then to almost like Cap looks purple in the last one because it's just like it's getting redder and redder. It's more intense, you know. And then, you know, Cap utters in a very tiny word balloon, "No. Oh, no." And then in panel five, that's in panel five. And then in panel six, you have Cap in shadows as he raises his shield above his head. And you got this, you know, typical radiant burst behind him. And the Baron's hands are still just like clawing at his body. And then panel seven is actually focused on Union Jack, which is interesting. He's backed up against the wall. He's kind of got his arm in front of his face. He's just got this, even with a mask that only shows his eyes, you can just read that he's aghast as the shadow of Cap's head and shoulders is against the wall. And you can see the shield come down because you don't actually see him, like, you know, cut his head off.
Right.
It's very tastefully done. But you got the motion lines and you have that horrific sound effect, which we mentioned, that chuck sound effect. I mean, it's just, damn. And then, you know, then we act on the next page, you actually see that his body and his head are separated.
Right.
As Cap's like, it's over Cap's shoulders. You're looking down on him and the body's like smoking.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just like, wow. I've always just, the first time I read that, I was like, oh my God, I just couldn't get over it. And that's still just like, that's one of those few times it's like, there's a few things in comics that it's like, it's just like movies. Those moments that it's just, it's exciting. It just sticks in your head. It's a big reveal. It's a shocking moment. There's just a few here and there that kind of jump out at you, you know, that are like, that is awesome. You know, mm-hmm. like, you know, it just, that's one of them. So were you surprised that Joey was Union Jack and not Kenneth?
What threw me about that is that when he is speaking, when Union Jack is speaking, he uses proper grammar. Whereas Joey, in all of his previous monologue and everything, it was all, you know, slang and everything else.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
if he's going to wear the flag, he's going to have to speak with a proper British accent. I know what you mean, yeah.
I know. I was just like, and I know it was a device to trick you into thinking that it was Kenneth rather than Joey, but at the same time, would Joey be able to do that?
Hmm.
You see what I'm saying? Because right. It didn't fit for the established character at that point.
Right, right. I gotcha.
He shouldn't have spoke at all. It should have just been action if they wanted to do that.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, the cover's a cheat because it shows the feeble Lord Falsworth getting up out of the chair. He is in the suit, but he never gets up out of the chair, obviously.
What kills me is, I don't know if you noticed that, but even the wheelchair has a Union Jack pillow on it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, a Union Jack pillow you could actually get, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, it's the British flag, obviously. But Lord Falsworth dying now that he knows he can have peace was very poetic, you know.
Yeah,
that was
a
very poetic end. And you know, you get the symbolic figure of Union Jack, but in addition to that, it has the final page has a nice stirring tribute to England in the will of its people, and it's really nicely done.
Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, him passing away, he didn't have this big, long, oh, Jackie, take care and make sure that he does a good job as Union Jack and blah, 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 that poetic bullshit that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
He died. It was over. I mean, because that's what happens when people die.
Yeah.
You don't have this long time to say goodbye. They die.
Right. Yeah, exactly. They rolled. He was obviously alive when they went out there.
Right.
And as they burned his body at some point, he died.
Yeah.
And when they went to talk to him, he was gone, you know. I know Byrne was a native of England. He relocated to Canada and then to the U.S., so this was the British tribute was probably more of his idea than, mm-hmm. than Stern's, but I don't know that. That's just a guess. And they dedicate this story to Frank Robbins, who was the co-creator of Union Jack with Roy Thomas and was the original artist on the Invaders series. So,
well, I can understand. I mean, you have told me you've got to read this, you've got to read this, but I actually had not read this story until like yesterday when we were getting ready to record this. So I hadn't read it before. You have talked about it and talked about it, and I knew what was going to happen at the conclusion of it. But this is the first time I'd actually read the story, and it was really good. I understand why you hold it in such high regard.
Oh, well, good. So I didn't like, oh, that wasn't that good. You know? I didn't overhype it for you there.
No, no.
That's saying something, too. So, you know, this is an absolute classic in my opinion and the opinion of many others. In fact, Michael Bailey and Andy Leyland did this on Views from the Long Box last year on the 4th of July, which is why I didn't cover it on House of Frankenstein last year.
Yeah.
So that's why I didn't cover it. It's got some great character moments. It's steeped in Marvel history, both old and recent for the mm-hmm. time. You know, everyone is left changed at the end of the story. Even Cap, you know, he's forced to do something that's hard to fathom even for him. I mean, you know, like we talked about on Adventures of Captain America episodes, you have to imagine that Captain America had to kill people in World War II.
Right.
But this was, I mean, I know the guy's undead, but this was like one-on-one murder. You know, I mean, he had to murder him. I mean, I know he didn't really murder him because he was already dead, which we got into that discussion before too. But he had to end him, like, barehanded.
Right.
Well, shield-handed, I guess. But, you know, you were talking about Chris Evans. I would love to see this in a movie. I mean, you know, I was talking to, we'll get into this later, I was talking to Rob Kelly. And we were talking about, well, I'll just go ahead and say, we recorded a Power Records episode. That's probably, it'll be out by the time, I think it'll actually be out today as we record this. But it'll be out by the time this airs. They showed like all the Marvel heroes and the Marvel monsters of the time together in the back of this Power Records comic. And I was saying to Rob, you know, how cool would it be when we're done with all the cosmic stuff with the Infinity Gauntlet and everything, that their next phase would be like a horror phase.
Yeah.
And they could beat Universal to the punch because Universal can't get their ass in gear and put out this Universe thing. And they could do you could do Werewolf by Night, you could do their own Dracula. And you could have Baron Blood in the Captain America movie.
Right.
And I'm not going to say who Rob cast as Baron Blood. Now, you go listen to the Power Records episode, but as soon as he said it, I'm like, oh my God, man, that's awesome. So it's just like, yeah, go listen to that Power Records episode if you haven't already. These stories were reprinted in one of those great little, you know, paperback novel, Marvel Illustrated books. They were black and white reprints. It came out in the early 80s. It's got a really great painted cover, which I cribbed for the cover of our episode. I never had it, but it's the cover's a recreation of this issue, number 254, by Bob Larkin, and it's really nice. And it's also reprinted in the Captain America War and Remembrance trade paperback, which collects the entire equally excellent Stern and Byrne run. And in fact, the next issue in their run was the retelling of Cap's origin, which we touched on in that Adventures mm-hmm. of Captain America. We referenced back because obviously they referenced it. But that was the last issue, and then they were done. They had planned an epic two-part Red Skull story, and editor-in-chief Jim Shooter suddenly decided, no more multi-part stories. So rather than compromise, because they'd already got the okay from him for it, and then he changed his mind, they both just left the book. And it's really a real shame, so way to go, Jim Shooter. Thanks. I was struggling. Cindy got tired of me talking about, well, what movies should we do? What comics should we do? What movie, you know, just for months before the House of Frankenstein started.
My God.
I'd come up with a list, and I'd revise the list, and I'd revise the list again, because it's trying to connect the comic to the movie. You know, I want them to sync up, you know, in some fashion. So I was thinking about doing Return of the Vampire anyway, so we'd have a good Bela Lugosi movie, and right. one that some people probably hadn't heard
aware
of.
Aware of, yeah.
And where he's essentially Dracula again. And you said, kind of unrelated, but you said, hey, why don't you do that Baron Blood Captain America story you're always talking about? And then it just clicked in my head. It's like, oh my God, that's perfect, because you've got the World War One and World War Two setting. Mm-hmm. You've got the setting in takes place in England.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the vampire that has been destroyed, and he comes back to enact revenge on the family that destroyed him.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a perfect combination. So
who was right?
You were right.
Okay, it's recorded. It's out there on the internet. It's my new ringtone. Say it again.
No. So that'll do it for the House of Frankenstein this year. We had a lot of fun. We're going to call in Peter Cushing to, you know, to board up the place and put crosses all over it or something. And, you know, but
windmill it.
Windmill it, yeah. But we're done. I'm kind of sad. I'm actually pretty sad to be done with it. I had a lot of fun, and I think you did too. We both had fun. So, but before we sign off, a few shout outs and some notes here. Like I said, me and Rob recorded a Power Records, but we also recorded a Film and Water episode, which is another side series of Fire and Water, where Rob talks about movies with different guests, and I've been on there before talking about Superman the movie, but we recorded one on Mad Monster Party.
Mm.
So that should be out. And that way, I was really struggling with, okay, the list of movies that I finally ended up with, I'm like, I've got no Boris Karloff. There's no Boris Karloff in this. That's not right. I love Boris Karloff. I've got Lugosi twice. I've got Chaney, but I've got Lee and Cushing. I got Cushing twice. There's no Boris Karloff. And then me and Rob were talking about doing a Film and Water, and he said, do you like Mad Monster Party? I'm like, oh, yeah, I love Mad Monster Party. Kids watch it every year. And I'm like, Boris Karloff.
So, there you go.
So we didn't do Boris here, but we took care of him on Film and Water. That's Rob's show, but, you know, I was over there on it, so I feel that made it okay with me. So if you like classic horror movies or horror movies and you like, you want to hear more podcasts about them, I'm going to recommend a few that I've already mentioned before, but I'll mention them again. Monster Kid Radio with Derek M. Cook, that he covers the classic and sometimes not so classic genre cinema of yesteryear, as he calls it. And so basically anything from like the dawn of movies until like 1968, I think he's cut off, or maybe 1970. So right up through there. And that's a great show, and it's great variety of different monster movies he covers. Can't recommend it enough. That's at monsterkidradio.net or on iTunes, of course. Derek also is one of the guys that hosts 1951 Down Place with Scott Morris and Casey Criswell. They cover the Hammer movies over there. All Hammer movies, not just horror, but of course there's a good chunk of Hammer that's horror. That's at 1951downplace.com. And then there is the Vault of Starling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, the longest podcast title in history, is a Two True Freaks production with Chris Honeywell, Sean Engel, Chris Tyler, and Luke and Jason Jack and Eddie. They cover more modern horror movies from like the 70s on. And that's a really fun show, and it's at twotruefreaks.com and, of course, on iTunes. So if you're in a horror mood all year long, listen to those. Great shows. Can't recommend them enough. So check those out. As for us, next time, we're going to, like we said, close up the House of Frankenstein, and we're going to go back to Opal City for part 3 of the Starman Chronicles, plus your feedback.
There you go.
So come back then, and we hope you have a happy Halloween, and go get dressed up, have fun, toilet paper houses, get candy.
Just not ours.
Just don't toilet paper our house. Yeah, thanks. So we'll see you then. Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright by respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com. Comments can be left at our blog at supermatescomic.blogspot.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates Podcast. Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
Now you kids gather around. Call in this house. There is something special going down.
Nobody must disturb me. Nobody. Do you understand? I sleep during the day.